You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Wontoku ingoa. E whakarongo ana koe ki te waia marunga irirangi poho mō tēnei rā, te rārua teko o Haratoa. Nau mai, haere mai. Kia ora, you're tuned into the Thursday Wire on 95BFM for today, rapida the 20th of May. It's budget day today and I finally, after 2 months talking to myself for an hour, I have a producer in the name of Louis McAllister. How are you?
I'm great. Grand even.
How does it feel? This is your Wire debut.
Excited.
No more. Hopefully we haven't been exerting too much pressure on you.
No, of course not.
I'm sure you'll do well. FIKNA up on the show today. We have our regular update with Radio Adelaide Zoe Canandes on Neighbourhood Watch. The government is announcing its budget today, with the health and early childhood education sector wanting to have a larger slice of the pie. A driver's license awareness group is saying it takes up to 3 months to wait to sit for a practical test, and a Green Party motion to declare Palestine a state has failed in Parliament yesterday. Hey, Ofakado, let me and Louis know what you think about all of this. Tuku patuhi mai, you can text us on 5395 or Waimaira. Or why my rane? Give us a call on 309-3879. Ko wa e ware ware e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anohi pakihere rokiroki marunga i te paitukutuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM i rakati.com. As always, you can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. I tēne wā tonu. Now it's time for the budget.
What a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
The government will be announcing the budget at 2 p.m. today. Finance Minister Graham Robertson has said this year's budget will have to balance the social impact of the COVID-19 pandemic against the burden of future generations, but it is expected that benefits will go up. The health sector is hoping to get more money from the government, with it already setting aside $53 million to implement a new primary cervical cancer test, $55 million on upgrading the national breast screening program, and another $10 million to catch up on missed breast cancer screening because of COVID-19. Tim Tembensell is an associate professor in health policy at the University of Auckland, and I asked him what he thinks about the budget announcements on health so far. Well, the pre-budget, so far we know from the budget for the health sector, is from pre-budget announcements, which is the $40 million investment into women's health, particularly in cervical cancer. What do you think about this, what's being announced so far?
Well, I'll start off by saying I haven't been keeping a close eye on the pre-budget announcements. There's often lots of these. They're often, I guess, in health terms, small amounts of money, which, you know, in terms of cervical cancer, that might be, you know, a significant increase in that particular area of service, but it's... you know, when we think about the overall health budget is close to $20 billion, you know, I guess the things I'm sort of looking more at the macro level.
Okay.
So, you know, what the overall, you know, sort of increase in total health spending will be. Yes, there's always a bunch of, you know, small initiatives, and they're usually well justified. I think in most cases they're often things that have been maybe overdue, or, you know, a good case has been made for them. So yeah, I don't have much debate about that, really.
Okay, but like you said, on the overall level, how much should the health sector get?
How much should it get? Well, you know, you need to... That's a much bigger conversation, because that's always in relation to how much should education get, how much should social welfare get, how much should transport get. That's that's the job of the government to sort of balance those things. They all need, you could argue, need more. In terms of health, you know, one important thing that's sort of, I don't know, specific to health, but, you know, it takes significant increases just to stand still, put it that way. So, you know, there's all sorts of things that are driving cost, health spending, including, you know, availability of new technology, the ageing of the population, the sort of the nature of the wage pressures, salary pressures in the health sector. It all means that spending on health tends to sort of rise faster in any country than spending in other areas. It often means you've got to sort of just increase the budget. Governments have to sort of increase the budget 3 or 4 or 5% a year just to stand still.
Right. And interesting that you mentioned some aspects such as the aging population, because especially what happened last year and during the election, there have been mentions of a lot of health service being underfunded.
Yeah, well, that's the legacy of the last 10 years. You know, so what we know is that certainly from about 2010 to about 2018. Per capita health funding stayed flat. You know, almost didn't change at all. So when you consider that you know the cost increase, you know that generally means we went backwards for nearly a decade. That's the squeeze that was put in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. But you know, I think most people would have understood that you know. 3 or 4 years of that was justifiable, but it's the fact that things didn't catch up after that, which is the pressures you're seeing now.
Okay. Still, there have been in the past mentions of a lot of services being underfunded, like
yes.
Dental health care. How, like, what...
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, dental health care is not funded for adults. Pure and simple, you know, apart from an emergency, you know, so it hasn't been a government responsibility, so it doesn't come under the budget. If the government could decide to do it, it would be hugely expensive, or cost a lot of money. So, you know, that's probably $1 billion straight off to do that, to make dental care accessible to adults.
Okay, but...
So that's a huge, big ticket item. Which, you know, most countries sort of shy away from that one, actually. So, you know, they're probably sort of strategies in between making it means tested or things like that, but it hasn't been on the agenda, basically. So I don't expect to see that.
Okay, but what should the government prioritise? Well, even though it's already long decided.
What should it prioritise in health? Okay. Well, in my view, it's important really to prioritise, it's always important to prioritise primary health care in the community, because left to its own devices, the health budget, the hospital sector soaks up more and more resources of the total health budget, just, you know, left to itself. That's what's happened. You know, spending in primary care and community services is whether it's done well, is preventative. You pick up cancers earlier, for example. That's a big issue that we have. You know, sort of the reason we are behind on cancer is, you know, it's got something to do with the treatments available at tertiary level, but it's more about people being diagnosed late, and that's got to do with access to primary care and the fact that in New Zealand, most people here pay a co-payment to go and see a GP. That's not the case in many other countries we compare ourselves to.
Do you expect the budget to less any funding for setting up Health New Zealand?
Oh, absolutely. Would have to. Yeah. I mean, you can't do those reforms without allocating money to them, yeah.
But how much how much is it needed to properly fund the independent health authority, to fund the overarching health agency?
I think that's an impossible question to answer, really, Pastor. Well, they're not, you know, they're just doing the, they're doing something, you know, it's not brand new in the sense that the money was always going through DHBs, now that money will go through Health New Zealand. So that's the same money. There will be setup costs and, you know, sort of, you know, in terms of change, all the costs that go with you know, a big organisational structural change, that needs to be done. But, you know, how much does Health New Zealand need? Well, it's going to take about 90% of the overall budget anyway, if, you know, so we follow what's in the Cabinet paper. 85-90% I would predict of total health spending. So, you know, I'll just do the math.
That was Tim Temensel from Auckland University talking to me about what should the health sector get from this year's budget. The early childhood education sector also says they need more help on reducing operating costs for childhood centres, despite the government promising pay parity between early childhood and kindergarten teachers. Peter Reynolds is the chief executive of the Early Childhood Council, and he spoke to me this morning about what the sector wants to see from the budget.
Well, we're in full support of it. We've been fighting for it for over a decade. Teacher pay parity, particularly between teachers working in childcare centres and their colleagues working in kindergartens, has been considerably different and growing in difference over recent years. A lot of this is because of the intervention in the way the funding model works, as influenced by government. So where government has had such a direct influence over the teacher pay packets, we believe they need to take corrective action to ensure pay parity for teachers who do the same job across the sector. So we support that move 100%. Where we have a problem is that over the same period, over the last decade or so, the per child rate of subsidy funding that goes to a childcare centre has been allowed to decrease. So that's cost the average childcare centre around about $120,000 per year off their bottom line. Now, no small business can sustain that sort of loss. So we are calling on the government to make a small contribution toward those per child rates of funding in order to take the pressure off parents and certainly take the pressure off centres that are struggling to survive.
Okay, but how much does the sector need in order to help reduce those costs?
We haven't done the full maths because centres operate in different ways and have different financial configurations, but we believe that between a 5 and 9% increase would accommodate the losses that have been incurred over the last decade. We don't expect the government to fully fund this. We're quite reasonable. We know that the government has other priorities as well. But anything toward this, say in the order of around 5%, would go some way toward reducing the pressure that centres are under.
Okay, but if the funding, if there isn't any additional funding from the government in the budget, how would this impact early childhood care centres?
We're going to see more centres close. We've already seen some shutting their doors because the pressure is just too great. We're going to see teachers losing jobs, and we're going to see families struggling because the amount of choice that they have about where their child can access quality early childhood education is going to diminish.
But would even though full pay parity is good for the teachers, is that a good thing for the centre's financial situation?
Not so much for the centre's financial situation, but certainly it benefits the teachers. Understand that a childcare centre, 77% on average of their expenses goes in salaries and wages. So that's by far the lion's share. But it still means that there's around 26-25% of a centre's expenses goes toward paying things like rent, materials and resources to deliver their program, maintenance costs, contribution to professional development, and so on. Now, all of those things add up, and unfortunately, as we all know, over the last few years, all of those things have increased in price. Where the government pays the lion's share of the investment in cost to deliver a quality early childhood education service in New Zealand, and they start pulling back on that investment, it means that there's really only one other option that a centre has faced, and that is to turn to parents and say, you need to pay more. We don't believe that that's sensible. We don't believe in many cases that it's viable to do so. Many childcare centres operate in communities where parents simply cannot afford to make that sort of contribution. Okay. So we're calling on the government to pick up that slack.
Okay. Is the sector also facing shortages on teachers?
Yes.
But do you think the government should, the budget should address that?
It's not, I mean, it is in part a financial issue. The teacher pay parity initiative is going to go some way toward addressing that. But you can throw bucket loads of money at a teacher shortage. That doesn't invent bodies on the ground. So trying to sort out the teacher shortage is actually quite a complex issue. It involves things like enabling some overseas trained teachers to come into the country. And we can't do that when the borders are closed or restricted. It means trying to encourage more student teachers to go through teacher training and ensuring that the quality of that training is up to scratch. And all of that sort of stuff takes time. For example, I understand that the number of student early childhood teachers going through training at the moment is amongst the highest number that they've had. Yet it still takes 3 or 4 years to start to see any result in terms of graduates. So what do we do in the meantime? Do we just pull up the tent and say, well, sorry, we can't offer a service for a while until we see those graduates come through? And then we've got a problem because the number of student ECE teachers going through the system currently does not match the number of advertised vacancies. We need far more than what are going through the current system. Hence the reference to looking at a border or an import issue as well to help complement and take the pressure off.
Okay.
So it's one of these issues that it needs to be looked at. It's quite complex. It's not simply a matter of throwing money at it.
That was Peter Reynolds of the Early Childhood Council talking to me about what the sector needs from the budget. E whakarongo ana ki koe ki te irirangi pōho. You tuned into The Thursday Wire with me, Justin Wong and Louis McAllister on 95BFM. Let me know what you think about this. Tuku pātuhi mai. The text number is 5395 or why mai. The phone number is 309-3879. It's 25 past noon. You tuned into 95BFM. We will be back after a break.
The majestic wonders of the ancient world. The pyramids at Giza. The cunning riddle of the Sphinx.
But now one ancient secret has been solved by the good people at Bread and Butter.
Their ancient grain sourdough uses heritage cereals, Khorasan, spelt and sorghum, and follows the age-old method of sourdough fermentation dating back to ancient Egypt. So it's great for your gut, tastes delicious, and is better for the planet. Ancient grain sourdough at Bread and Butter, Grey Lynn, Ponsonby, and the Coast Plaza in Whangaparoa. Order online at breadandbutter.nz.
Tinnitus can be defined as
a false perception of a sound and the absence of an acoustic stimulus.
It sounds a bit like this. Otago University is conducting a study to better understand early stage tinnitus. They're asking people who have recently begun to experience tinnitus to complete an online survey to help with their research. If that's you, register now at tinnitus.nz. You'll receive a token of gratitude for your time. That's tinnitus.nz.
The fun and fascinating, the intriguingly delicious world of food trucks is coming to Motad. Whether you're vegan, veggie, gluten-free or whatever, there'll be truckloads of tasty options for you to try from famous The Food Truck Collective. Plus, heart-pounding entertainment from Pacific professional dance group Musa Samba Passion, Tamashii Taiko drummers and more. Motat's Food Truck Roundup, May 21st, 22nd and 23rd, 5:30 to 8:30 p.m, free entry. Find out more at motat.nz.
Thick, rich, rich velvet, truffle oil on prosciutto, the good cat food with the gooey bits.
But nothing out there is quite as fancy as the 95BFM Fancy New Band Showcase.
Featuring Emmanuel,
Zoe Moon,
Greco Romank,
Elena,
Messiah,
Sol Labasa,
Van Staden and Boom,
Ludus,
and Jules Acab.
Parrot Dog Beer and Happy Hour Hard Kombucha present 95BFM Fancy New Band Showcase. May 28th, the Wine Cellar, Whammy Bar and Backroom. Entry by donation.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire, and now, 100 working days or 3 months. That is the time needed to wait to sit for a practical driver's license test, according to a concern group. The Driving Change Network is a group across the driver's education, training and licensing sectors. They say there are numerous barriers preventing people from learning to drive, with an estimate 70 to 90,000 people struggling to get a license, and it deepens social inequities. Wendy Robertson is the network's coordinator, and I started by asking why waiting times are so long.
So in some regions, we get together on a monthly basis, and one of the huge barriers that is reported by our members for young people or members of the community that they're supporting to getting a licence is the long wait in which there is to get a practical driving test. And for some of our people that we're supporting through that licensing journey, it means that, you know, they can't get a job or they lose interest, and then for some of them they don't continue towards completing a full New Zealand licence.
Okay, how many people do you think can't get a full-time job because they don't have a license?
Well, I wouldn't be able to say I couldn't put a number on it actually, but I know it affects many people. MSD themselves state that 80% of jobs require a license as a prerequisite. If you're unemployed and have no access to a license, and then that's potentially an issue for you. Not to mention, we have members in Tairāwhiri, up from Gisborne, and their issues are even greater because they don't have access to public transport.
Okay.
A license is even more important for the likes of those people.
Okay. I kind of want to go back to the earlier issue on the long wait times. Why does it take 104 working days to wait to sit for a driver's test?
I think it's just the current capacity of the VTNZ testing stations and the number of testers that they have available. And the demand is really high at the moment for practical tests.
Now, your organisation on your website also said up to 70 to 90,000 people are struggling to access with the licence system. What do you mean by this?
So that was figures done in a MB report that showed 70 to 90,000 people struggled to gain a full licence. And those are people, for various reasons, face barriers to the licensing system. So it could be finance. It could be that they have no access to a licensed driver who can teach them to drive. They may not have a suitable vehicle to learn in. They may not own a warranted or registered vehicle. Having the long waits for the test or being able to access a nearby testing station is another reason why they're struggling.
I took my learner's test myself last December, and it's quite expensive actually, almost $100 just for the learner's test, then $135 for the restricted test, and $110 for the full learner's test. Is it too expensive? from the perspective of licensing from the industry?
Not the initial tests. We realise that there are costs involved and that it has to be recouped by somebody. And our testing fees, in comparison to other countries, aren't that bad. But where it gets really hard is on top of that, there are retest fees. So had you not passed your learner's licence the first time, then you would have been faced with a further $48 fee to try again. And you can imagine, for a family who possibly had to save to be able to afford the initial test, and for various reasons, nerves, not being prepared, whatever the case is, they fail, then that additional $48 could be a real reason why they wouldn't attempt to sit their test again.
Okay. I guess for the same low for the families who are in low socioeconomic conditions, driving lessons can also be a burden, is it?
I would say that for people in those situations, driving lessons would not be an option. They have, you know, on average, you're looking at about $70 an hour for a lesson. And for those types of families, I think just coming up with a test fee would be hard work.
Okay, but what can the government do to reduce this number?
Well, that's what Driving Change are hoping to work with the government to come up with a more equitable system where people who need assistance can easily access it. At the moment, I believe that some can access assistance through work and income, but not everybody is on a benefit that needs help with driver licensing fees. And I think, as many people in the community will know, that there's a growing working class poor, and for those people, we feel that there needs to be easy ways to gain assistance also.
Should driving lessons be brought back into the regular school curriculum?
We firmly believe that driving education and training should be offered at secondary school level. That way everybody will get basic driving education, and our road safety statistics will be better for it. We'll have safer road users throughout the country as a result.
Okay. I'm sitting on quite a precarious situation because I didn't go to school in New Zealand because I grew up in Hong Kong, but I didn't get my license there. And so far, and my family's overseas as well, so there's no full-time license holder to teach me how to drive. What sort of solutions are there available for people who don't have a car or could afford driver's lessons but still want to learn driving?
So there are numerous community organisations around New Zealand who offer support for people who don't have access to funds, a vehicle or a licensed adult to teach them to drive. And so for people who aren't in the school system and the likes of yourself, they could access those supports through those community organisations. And currently, Driving Change, alongside of the Ministry of Social Development, we are undertaking a mapping of these services so that access to a list of them is readily available for all New Zealanders.
That was Wendy Robertson from the Driving Change Network. If you want to let me know what you think of this, you can text in on 5395 or call in on 309-3879. Now, let's go to Australia.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
This week on Neighbourhood Watch, government agencies sent a link to not pay 130 people who were diagnosed with a terminal illness their disability support pension before they passed away. But I began with Radio Adelaide's Zoe Canandis on Media Network 9's poll showing 30% of its respondents are unwilling to get vaccinated against COVID-19. Here's Zoe.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting statistic. So I would like to acknowledge that Channel 9 and this Channel 9 poll, you know, probably did cover a very good amount of people, but it also was just a poll by a media organisation here in Australia. But this survey has shown that 30% of people are most likely unlikely to be vaccinated with the COVID-19 jab. I think I've spoken to you all before. There has been much of a muck around when it comes to the distribution of our COVID-19 jab. For example, we had 4 million people to be vaccinated by the end of April, I think it was, and that didn't quite happen. I think we got to about 1.3, but we were, you know, we were almost 3 million short of our target. So it's really interesting to see the statistics that 30% of people might not even get it, which is really interesting because Scott Morrison has been quite dismissive of really getting into a conversation about vaccination, also really dismissive about getting into a conversation about opening up international borders. This, for me personally, my own little analytical brain, would like to point out that it is an election year. Potentially, the earliest we can call the election is in August, I think. And so it's really interesting to see Scott Morrison become really indifferent to a solid vaccine rollout. It feels like he's taking a real no-rush approach to a vaccine rollout, also a real no-rush mentality towards opening up international borders as well. So it's funny that the public conscious now is 30% of people probably won't get it. Is that because our Prime Minister isn't really being, he's sort of fence-sitting on the issue here in order to save himself a bit? I mean, Scott Morrison has been through a plague of scandals in the past year, from how he's addressed COVID to the sexual assault allegations we've seen in Parliament and the Me Too movement we've been seeing growing from Canberra. You know, is he just trying to play quiet in order to save himself a little bit? But thus, that means that the country isn't really getting the vaccine rollout that we need, and we probably won't be opening international borders for quite a while.
Okay, but so far, who can get the vaccine in Australia? Because I know my uncle, he's around middle-aged. He already got the AstraZeneca vaccine in Sydney.
Yes, so there are people, elderly people over the age of 60 or people who are at higher risk who are definitely first in, first served, which is absolutely fair enough. So that is the approach we're taking here in Australia, that they will be getting the vaccination first. I'm in my mid-20s, I'm young, and I'm not super high risk in terms of my job. So I don't, for me, and not that it matters, obviously people who need it first should be getting it first, but I don't have any indication of when I would be getting a jab whatsoever. I'm hoping towards the end of the year, but there's no sort of plan for me. There's nothing that I can look to and say, yep, in October I can get the vaccine. I have literally no idea. And a fair amount of the country is like that. We just don't know.
But do you think, well, 30% of people saying they won't get vaccinated is a sense of complacency against the pandemic in Australia?
Yeah, potentially. Australia definitely, we were able to, except for places like Victoria, we were sort of able to go back to normality quite quickly. And so complacency came in a rush after that. And it also, yes, I agree with that point. Because we've been able to sort of relax a little bit, complacency in every sort of facet has definitely been on the rise. I mean, you walk around Adelaide and you wouldn't have even thought there was a global pandemic, except for the fact that we all have to scan into every shop we go to. There's also been sort of no government massive campaign or urgent national campaign sort of aimed at boosting the take-up of rate, or there's not been much of a national conversation about the importance of this vaccine. So I think that also ties into it as well, which I think is related to Scott Morrison's complacency in order to save himself a little bit for an election coming up potentially very soon.
Okay, moving on to our second topic of this week. Now, a muck-up at the Welfare Agency Centre Link, should I say about that, has, a muck-up at Welfare Agency Centre Link has caused some 130 people to die of a terminal illness before getting a disability pension.
This is quite harrowing. We've seen some new data, and it's revealed that, 130 people who were diagnosed with a terminal illness have unfortunately passed away before Centrelink were able to give them any disability support pension. This happened last year. These figures were sort of provided to the Senate in response to questions from the Greens, who described this occasion as obviously very unacceptable. People who have a terminal illness, they're not required to go through the sort of full application process for their Centrelink. So that is welfare payments here in Australia. So it means that their claims should really be prioritised by Centrelink. And unfortunately, we've seen this massive mishap happen. Assessing the disability support pension means the person is paid at a base rate of about $950 a fortnight. This is compared to $620 for job seeker payments. It's quite harrowing to see this statistic and why this has happened and the damage this potentially could have done to those people's lives. In recent years, the disability payment has become increasingly difficult to obtain. Centrelink have really tightened the eligibility and application requirements imposed. This is, set, and these application requirements are imposed by both Labor and Coalition. And it's a little frightening to see. I mean, we have our National Disability Insurance Scheme, which is such a complicated scheme, and we've seen not the right amount of money allocated to it, and we're not seeing the right kind of, we're not seeing justice for people in this country who need a disability support pension. I mean, A, they're not even able to get it, and B, they're not getting it in time, which is just awful to say at all. So this is quite a strike on both the Australian government's Labor and Coalition. Why is this happening? And why are we accepting this? And to see those figures having been revealed and knowing that they're going to Senate and they're in people's faces is a good thing, because it means that hopefully some change could be evoked, but hopefully some justice as well as to why these payments were never made in time is we really want to see that as well. Also, the data showed that in 5 years between 2006 and 2020, 2,026 people had also died before their disability support pension claim was approved. That's about an average of 405 per year. So, why are we letting 405 people die per year and they can't just get Centrelink to process a payment for them? They're terminally ill. They shouldn't have to wait. It's scary stuff.
Okay. Thanks so much for your time, Zoe, this morning.
No worries, my pleasure. My pleasure. Happy Budget Day, everyone. I hope you have a fantastic Budget Day.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
That was indeed Neighbourhood Watch with Radio Adelaide's Zoe Canandes. It's up to 13 to 1. You are listening to the Thursday Wire on 95 BFM, and we will be back after another break.
Thanks for coming in. Here's the script.
Once a year, the best of the best in brutal combat. 18 teams, but only one can take home New Zealand's most coveted prize. Blood, sweat, strong coffee. It can only be...
The Vista Foundation 48 Hours Grand Finals 2021. Mind-blowing films, electric atmosphere, an incredible panel of international judges including Elijah Wood and Cliff Curtis. Support our local filmmakers. The Vista Foundation 48 Hours Grand Finals 2021. May 22nd at the Civic Theatre. Get your tickets now from Ticketmaster.
Yeah, we'll try and get even grab... No,
the New Zealand Music Month Summit is back for 2021. Packed with everything you need to thrive in your career, whether you're an emerging artist or an established music professional.
Registrations are all snapped up, but you can join the waitlist at Eventbrite or stream the sessions about accessing support, touring and radio, producing music and much more.
New Zealand Music Month Summit 2021, Access All Aotearoa. Brought to you by MMF Aotearoa and the New Zealand Music Commission. Saturday, May 29th from 10 a.m. Go to nzmusicmonth.co.nz.
They said she'd never do it, but here she is, heading out of her province, the one and only Nadia Reid. If you want tickets to see her perform live, then just grab your B card and listen in to 95BFM all this week for your chance to win. I wanna feel good again. Banished Music in association with 95BFM presents Nadia Reid and her band. May 22nd at the Hollywood Avondale, sold out. May 23rd, tickets now available. Go to banishedmusic.com.
I think I'm ready for a B card.
The fact that you call it that tells me you're not ready.
Well, everyone calls it that. You can't just go in and ask for it.
Call it by its name.
Nobody says bosom card. It's a B card. That's fine. That's normal to call it a B card. People don't say bosom.
Some of us remember the old ways.
There's only one place to get a B card. Win, win, win sick prizes. Get incredible discounts and help us stay Auckland's best radio station since forever. Sign up for a B card from just $4.20 a month and support independent media. Go to 95bfm.com/sign up.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. And finally, for today, we have a story on Palestine. Louis, what have you got?
Yesterday, the Green Party made a motion to recognise Palestine as a state, as conflict has escalated between Israel and the military group Hamas. However, the bid to debate recognition in Parliament was rejected, with the National, Labour and ACT parties all declining to support the motion. I spoke to Green Party Foreign Affairs spokesperson Gauris Gariman about her party's position on the issue and the potential responses New Zealand could take. I began by asking her why the Green Party believed Palestinian statehood is important, and how this differs to the two-state solution supported by other parties.
Yeah, so the Green Party has had a long-standing position whereby we support the two-state solution. Israel is already a state, so the two-state solution by definition requires governments around the world to recognise Palestine as a state. It's sort of at best confused position to say that you support the two-state solution, but for taking any substantive steps to recognise Palestine, and at worst, I think, really cynical. So our point with bringing the motion was to recognise the humanity and dignity of the people of Palestine at a time when they face the worst violence they've seen. They see violence regularly, and it's an ongoing part of the occupation, but this latest bout has been the worst in some time. So we wanted to present something that would say to the world that Aotearoa New Zealand stands with the Palestinian people, but also stands for a lasting, sustainable peace.
In a press release rejecting the notion of Palestinian statehood, Jerry Brownlee stated that the National Party has consistently been in favour of the two-state system. What is your response to this?
Well, they don't stand for a two-state solution because they voted down Palestinian statehood. it is a requirement of the two-state solution that Palestine becomes a state and is recognised as a state alongside Israel. And the National Party objected to that. So they can no longer say that they support a two-state solution. This was the step, the core step that we need to take if there is to be a two-state solution, is to welcome Palestine into our community of states where Israel currently sits.
On Saturday, Green Party MP Ricardo Menendez tweeted a photo accompanied by the statement, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," which is a quote used by Hamas, who New Zealand label as a terrorist organisation. Do you think this poses a potential conflict of ideologies?
The slogan actually predates Hamas. So, you know, there's 2,000 people in Auckland chanting the same thing. Among them, there were Jews, even Israel-born Jews, Muslims, secular people like me, and so the idea of freedom for Palestinians in their ancestral land across that area shouldn't in any way threaten the peace and freedom of Israelis, and we would hope that it doesn't, and that's exactly why we're standing for independence for Palestine, freedom for Palestinians, and statehood for Palestine. That shouldn't be a threat to the state of Israel, and it certainly isn't a threat to the Jewish community, who've come out strongly for peace. In fact, on Parliament Steps yesterday, we had representatives of Alternative Jewish Voices, Aotearoa, who used the slogan. So I think it's again a cynical sort of accusation to say that anyone who stands for freedom for Palestine is advocating for terror.
Several Green Party members have expressed support for a petition by the Palestine Solidarity Network, Aotearoa, demanding that the government closes the Israeli embassy in Wellington and sever all domestic ties with the State of Israel. What do you have to say about this?
Yeah, I mean, that could be one of the steps that we take. Our first step was to strongly condemn both acts of ethnic cleansing in East Jerusalem, in the Sheikh Jarrah area, and also then the violence in Gaza, which we say amounts to crimes against humanity, and could also easily be seen as an act of ethnic cleansing, creating conditions of life that would mean that area is not conceivable home for Palestinians who've been there for generations and generations. We haven't seen that strong condemnation from the government, so we've come out strongly in criticism of them. Our next step, in close consultation with the Palestinian community, was to raise a motion, and the consensus response that I got was that they would prefer to focus on statehood, because that is a forward-looking recognition of their dignity and humanity. So that was the next step, and that was obviously rejected by all the political parties in Parliament other than the Māori Party, and obviously was on behalf of the Green Party. Next steps will be what we can do to strongly condemn Israel, whether that's cutting off diplomatic relations. I mean, it looks like the violence is only escalating, so that has to be that has to be a serious step that the government considers. I'm not that hopeful that they're considering anything like that, given that they haven't even supported a mere declaration of support for Palestinian statehood, and they haven't called the violence what it is, which is ethnic cleansing and an atrocity crime by Israel.
So what do you believe New Zealand's best response on the international stage should be to the ongoing conflict?
I think New Zealand should call this what it is, which is a state. This is one of the most powerful military forces in the world, is committing atrocity crimes, crimes against humanity, war crimes, that there must be accountability. And for those who say, you know, Hamas shouldn't aim rockets at civilians, well, yeah, that's true as well. There should be accountability for everyone, but the incredibly, overwhelmingly disproportionate violence is coming from the IDF. We should repeatedly, consistently and strongly call for Israel to keep to its recognised borders, to end the occupation, and call on our allies and friends and trading partners to enforce those borders. And we absolutely must recognise the fundamental rights of Palestinians to self-determination through statehood.
That was The Wire.
And that's all for the Thursday Wire today. Thank you to those who spoke to us today. We had Radio Adelaide, Zoe Canandes, Green MP Gorit Skaraman, Tim Tembenso of Auckland University, Peter Reynolds of the Early Childhood Council, and Wendy Robertson of the Driving Change Network. And also a big thank you to my new producer, Louis McAllister, for his work today. Ka hoki mai mātou a te rawiki. We'll be back next week. Up next, it's the 124 with Sam, who is filling in for Secret today. Enjoy your budget day. Enjoy the rest of your budget day, and I will catch you next time. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.